Welcome to World Policy on Air, a weekly podcast from the pages and website of World Policy Journal, published by the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. I'm David Alpern. In this week's program, posted December 8, 2017, we spotlight a recent talking policy feature on the World Policy blog about the state of media and literature in ever more tense Turkey, specifically the surprising popularity of a 75-year-old Turkish novel titled Madonna in a Fur Coat. We'll also preview top stories in the new WPJ winter issue, cover line Native Voices. But first, some timely insights from global affairs analyst and author Michael Moran, head of Transformative.io, risk and geostrategy consultants, and a visiting fellow at the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital city ends a long debate over this topic, and it tells us a number of things about President Trump. First, it confirms the priority he places on satisfying domestic constituencies, in this case, American Jewish voters and Christian evangelists who have longed for the U.S. Embassy to be moved from Tel Aviv, where it has stood since President Harry Truman midwifed Israel into existence in 1948. It also indicates a continuing disdain for the professional diplomats of the State Department, whose practiced, level-headed approach to many issues make them unpopular with those who prefer tough talk and shoot-from-the-hip policymaking. Nixon hated state so much he ran his whole foreign policy through the National Security Council of Henry Kissinger. State, in his day, opposed his secret war in Cambodia and Laos, his overthrow of Chile's elected president Salvador Allende, and so Nixon cut them out of the policy loop. Look how well that turned out. George W. Bush, too, saw state as an obstacle. He sandbagged his own Secretary of State, Colin Powell, into delivering false intelligence assessments of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction at the United Nations. In fact, as Powell knew, the State Department's own intelligence bureau was one of the few sounding the alarm over the slanted, often fabricated WMD intel. But Powell was a good soldier, and his intelligence people were told to be quiet. The resulting disaster still haunts us. It would be fair to say that the State Department today is deeply unhappy with the prospect of moving its ambassador to Jerusalem, a city that is central to the dispute between the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the wider Arab world. And here Trump betrays another deep misunderstanding. There was a time, perhaps immediately after World War II, for instance, when an American president could dictate such things, as Truman did. That time is over. Prematurely, for that matter, thanks to some of the very errors I just listed. The State Department, even in its weakened condition under Trump punching bag Rex Tillerson, would like to keep its embassy where it is. But once again, a president who thinks he knows best will prevail. And that is another tragedy. For World Policy on Air, I'm Michael Moran.
You're listening to World Policy on Air. Now this.
In Turkey, the new generation of writers all write about that kind of issues. Political problem, torture, Kurdish issue, homosexuality, everything. All of them are equally dangerous at the moment, so I'm not alone. We are being targeted, you know. We are being banished from universities.
Turkish author Bernd Sönmez at European Literature Night in London last year talked about the passion and pressures of a writer's life back home under the increasingly dictatorial Erdogan regime, with many journalists and writers either fleeing the country or facing arrest. But the dissident author of a current bestseller titled Madonna in a Fur Coat is in no danger, despite some of his novel's subversive social themes. The book was first published in 1943, and author Sabahattin Ali was killed 5 years later trying to flee across the border to Bulgaria. For a recent Talking Policy post on the World Policy blog, Maureen Freely, who translated Ali's work into English, discussed the state of Turkey's literary and media culture and why Ali's book resonates so strongly with readers today. Freely is also president of English Pen, defending writers and free expression, and we spoke the other day for this podcast. Maureen Freely, welcome to World Policy on Air.
Lovely to be with you.
Talk about the plot of Madonna in a Fur Coat and some of the key elements of this 75-year-old fiction that have made it so popular in a very different Turkey over the past 3 or 4 years. The importance of art, defying convention, even non-traditional gender roles.
Well, it's set in the faraway 1920s, the interwar period, and the story, nonetheless, is an echo of what many young Turks have experienced, which is a first visit to Europe. In this case, a young man who has been sent by his father to study the manufacture of soap in Berlin, and who secretly spends all his time reading literature and going to art galleries. And this is a big secret from his family that has no time for this sort of thing. Many young people all over the world, not just Turkey, will know what that's like these days in these utilitarian must study something that will keep you in the middle class times that we're in. He goes to one gallery. There's a kind of a group exhibition, and he happens on to a self-portrait, which is called Madonna in a Fur Coat. And he falls in love with the portrait. And he goes back every day to look at it. The woman in the picture seems to understand him. He finally makes the acquaintance of the artist. And then they have a very unusual friendship that doesn't... It's very, very intense, very passionate. But it doesn't obey any of the gender conventions of the time, or indeed of Turkey today, which has, after a renaissance of lasting 20-25 years, has become increasingly patriarchal, increasingly authoritarian, increasingly intolerant of anyone who isn't going to act like Erdogan's idea of a man or Erdogan's idea of a woman.
Talk more about the factors shaping the lives and tastes of young readers in Erdogan's Turkey. You talk about repression, Terenza, with that growing fear at home alongside what they know of the outside world from foreign visitors and especially now the internet.
Well, I think that, in the Turkey of my childhood, this is, we're talking about the 60s here, Turkey really was a pretty closed society. It was very, very difficult to go abroad, to get the permission, let alone the money to go abroad. There were just the first guest workers going from the poorest parts of the city and the country in general, going to Germany and other parts of northern Europe. But that was it. So the state, the Turkish state, really, really did have a stranglehold over the Turkish people and what they got to see and what they got to understand. There wasn't even television in those days. There was one radio station that was controlled by the state. And it was a substitution economy, so we didn't get very much from the outside world. Well, all of this changed, first of all, with what we'll now call globalization. And, of course, hand-in-hand with globalization comes the Internet, so that young people in Turkey by the 1990s were beginning to live those double lives that we see in so many other parts. In other words, I remember one of my students was a very pious headscarf wearing person, but she wore high top sneakers with her Islamic outfit, and she had a very, very good internet friend in Greece. That the sort of thing that was happening in Turkey then, but of course was happening in so many other parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America. Not to mention Europe and North America as well. So you have that opening up. At the same time, there is that renaissance I was mentioning. After the brutal coup of 1980. We had a bad decade, and then things got easier. And at that point, a lot of my contemporaries who had, many of whom had suffered two stints in political prisons, were out and continuing their careers and determined to create a culture in which Turkish readers and Turkish people, Turks involved in musical culture and film culture, could connect with their own past, you know, and reconnect with authors such as Sabahattin Ali, who had been suppressed and forgotten. So you had this kind of romance of republication and embracing again the authors who had been erased, the music that had been erased, the films that had been erased, and so on. And all of this leads eventually to the 2013 Gezi protests, in which mostly young people stand up and say to Erdogan, we want to have a choice to shape our own lives. We want to be who we are. If we're LGBT, we want to be able to stand up and say so proudly. If we want to go into the arts, we want to stand up and say so proudly. If we want to know our own history, if we want to acknowledge that we're not just Turkish, but partly Greek, partly Armenian, partly Jewish, or entirely of those minorities, we want to be able to say so and embrace our history. The Gezi protests went on for an extraordinarily long time when you think about, you know, what protests are and what the riot police that were surrounding them. But of course, you know, after about 6 weeks, they did come to an end. The crackdown on the part of Erdogan and his people becomes continuous from then on, and worse and worse.
So is there a certain safety in reading about these unconventional ideas in a setting so far before the Erdogan era that he and his followers can't take offense?
I think so. I think so. There's always been power in metaphor and allegory and resonance. I think that's what that's what literature is for. It's for, just think about how Shakespeare was resonant in Eastern Europe during the Cold War. How Shakespeare is resonant right now in the productions that we're seeing in Syrian refugee camps. It's a wonderful way of freeing yourself from the constraints in which you live, and also the divided loyalties that make it very hard to articulate. Thinking again of my student with a headscarf, who's very, very pious, but of course also wants to belong. It does belong to world culture and Western the world of Western ideas. It's far easier for somebody like her to pick up a book that's about a romance that took place 75 years ago, in which a lot of these tensions are playing themselves out, than for her to stand up to her Westernized classmates who hate her and say, well, actually, I agree with you on some points. It's just so polarized at the moment. I can understand why young people will take refuge in a book that plays these things, these questions out in safety, if you like.
Actually, given the fact that it's set in the 20s, it's 100 years or almost 100 years earlier. By contrast to its current popularity, the book was not universally acclaimed at first, even by friends of the author who liked his other work. Say more about that.
Sabahattin Ali was sort of recognized and applauded by, you know, Nazım Hikmet, who was the, you know, the greatest poet of the 20th century, really, and much revered during his lifetime, much of which he did spend in prison. And so he had a very, you know, high reputation from the first his very, very first publications in literary journals. But he never made money from writing. And he didn't have any family money because his family had lost everything in World War I. And, of course, because he was a socialist, or just because he was critical of Ataturk, it's not even because he was a socialist, he was in and out of prison. And it's very hard to work as a teacher if you are out of favor with the state because the teaching profession is entirely state-controlled. So it was felt when he published this book, which he wrote during a second stint of military service, that he was simply trying to support his family, and that it was a desperate thing to do, to write an unconventional love story in which men did not act like men. The literary scene was not entirely male at the time, but it was pretty much run by men who, you know, whatever they did privately, had a very, very kind of vocal commitment to very male maleness. So they just didn't know what to make of that. In general, the problem that people had with his novels is that he, in their eyes, was combining two forms that these very male authors thought should always be kept separate. And one is sort of a social realism, and the other, which is for men to do. And then the other one was romance, which was for women to do. And so he was gender bending in that way that made them very uncomfortable, I think. But also just made them, you know, not see the point of what he was doing. And it makes me admire him all the more.
And the woman that he falls in love with, the artist, is, as you say, unconventional. And say more about their relationship, which his contemporaries found so hard to accept, at least publicly.
Well, she's a very independent woman, and very outspoken, quite harsh in protecting her freedom. She's half Jewish. She spends a large part of their romance saying that she doesn't want there to be a romance and that she doesn't believe in love and so on. And he, Raif, our hero, he takes the passive role. He really respects her position as much as he longs for things to be different. And there's a lot of walking in this novel. They walk through so much of Berlin and its parks that I feel like I've been there myself. At a certain point, she falls ill and she does need him, and he does take care of her in a very manly way, you might say, but also in a very caring female way. So even when they shift roles, he's doing so in a way that it's interesting to read about now, and it's an eye opener for us to read it now and realize that there were people who were grappling with these things or shaping their personal lives in ways that we are trying to do now, and so we see that we have some noble ancestors in this endeavor.
Given his dissidence, his service both in the army and in prison, the fiction that he wrote, the journalism, the newspaper that he published, which was fairly strident, how does his personal history factor into the modern-day popularity of this book, do you think?
He is a story himself, in that he not only wrote independently, according to his own lights instead of according to the categories that were imposed on him. But also, as you mentioned, this extraordinary newspaper that he published with a number of other very mischievous writer friends, which is at the most fascist moment of 20th century Turkish history. What he and his and his friends were doing with Marco Pasha was making hysterically funny, vicious fun of the Turkish state and its prime minister and president. And to the extent that humor is not something that usually lasts very long, it's still really funny what they did. That, of course, in my view, is what what got him into big, big trouble, and why he wasn't able to find work, and so on. The people who are going in the authoritarian direction do not like to be laughed at. So after he got out of prison, because of what had been said in the satirical newspaper, that was the point at which he had to leave, because he was unable to make a living. He was unable to get a job in Turkey anymore, very much in the way that many civil servants and writers and academics find themselves unemployable today, and also unable to get a passport. So he did the desperate thing, and it was the truck driver he hired to take him across into Bulgaria. It turned out to be in cahoots with the secret police. He was then murdered. There was no news about his murder for 6 months, at which point a newspaper that was very, much aligned with state powers published kind of a still life, if you like, of all of his personal effects, his jacket, his glasses, a photograph of his wife, a copy of Eugene Onegin. And these personal effects were never returned to the family, nor was his body. That was meant to be that. And as far as Turkey is concerned, it was that for quite some time. Sabahattin Ali's daughter was advised never to mention to anyone who her father was when she was growing up. The book found a new home in Bulgaria, where it became something that was studied in secondary schools, and it was well known, still well known there, but it became well known throughout Eastern Europe and also in the Soviet Union. At the very, very end of the 20th century, so I'm saying around 1998-99, during the Renaissance I was mentioning before, a pioneering publishing house started bringing out the lost works of the 20th century and published all of the works of Sabahattin as part of that series. It's at that
in
point...
In Turkey, published
in Turkey.
Yeah.
So not until 1998 does it come back into Turkey. And then it's sort of... although his complete opus is there, available, it's this book that gets picked up by young people and passed around. Now, so we've almost had two generations of readers now. So the first generation of readers are they're people who are pretty much born in the shadow of the 1980 coup, and at a time when Turkey is opening up, and they themselves are going to Europe for the first time to study, and to travel, and so on and so forth. And the generation now is the generation after that that is having to cope with those doors that had opened now closing again. And so I think the resonances for today's young people are even more poignant than the resonances of its, first new readers back in Turkey.
It also proves the power, the survivability of literature and its continuing importance, or its ability to be important at different times to different people.
Yes. If there's love in it, if there's love in it, and if there's truth in it, I would say this book has turned me into a romantic.
Looking at the Turkish literary scene and the increasingly constrained media sphere, do you see any change in the role of literature and novels playing in a space that might have been occupied by more overtly political work in a less hostile atmosphere?
Well, one thing to remember about the Turkish intelligentsia and the Turkish cultural sphere, is that it is no longer contained by the borders of Turkey. And this is partly because of the number of people who had to leave in the wake of the 1980 coup. And now, of course, we have these new waves of people coming out now. And also the extraordinary courage of people even today, publishers even today in Turkey are bringing out books that are dangerous to the security of their publishing houses, and then put them at risk of being in prison. So there's still publishing going on. There is there are some houses, publishing houses, that are being careful or being too careful. But the extraordinary thing is the amount that's still happening, you know, because if I were a publisher, I don't know if I would find the courage to be publishing some of these things in Turkey at the moment. Of course, literature allows us to look at these things indirectly, and we can always find ways to be free inside the stories that we invent. That is certainly going on at the moment. There is a renaissance of cultural expression. What we're doing in England right now, and particularly in London, and I think we'll probably see the same sort of thing in Berlin, in Paris, in various North American cities as well, where there are sort of large Turkish populations, is we see networks setting up here of Turkish writers, so that we and they can carry on doing their work even though they're not at home right now.
You talked about the bravery of publishers. What about the personal danger of the actual writers of fiction?
They're in personal danger. I mean, you can just look at the example of Aslı Erdoğan, who was in prison last year, and it was, you know, thanks to international pressure, in part at least, that she was released. Always remember that it's so dangerous to exercise freedom of expression in Turkey that if you're a novelist, you're probably doing other things as well. For example, in the case of Aslı Erdoğan, she was part of a collective that was trying to keep open a newspaper that was run by the kind of the democratic Kurdish movement. So one of the reasons she's in prison is because of the activities she's involved in as a writer to keep keep the spaces open for proper democratic discussion. Also, and this is really important to remember, as a translator, I must say this: it is very dangerous to be a translator in Turkey. Because if you translate something that the state doesn't like, you get prosecuted as well. If the publisher gets prosecuted, the author gets prosecuted, and if it's something from abroad, the translator gets prosecuted. And can and does go to jail. And if there's a charge of terrorism, which can be applied to just about anything these days, it can be a very, very long time before you even know what the charges are.
What do you hope English-speaking audiences outside Turkey will take away from reading Madonna in a Fur Coat, certainly in the English versions that you've helped create?
Well, when I give the book to young people here, the interesting thing is they'll say, well, it's clearly, an old book written in a way that sets it in the time that it was written, but the concerns are so contemporary. And the main concern that they talked to me about here, bear in mind that I teach here at a university, they talk about the secret shame of loving literature and loving art, and that is something that they have to either hide or defend as they go through university and think about their futures. So that's something that I wasn't really expecting, but I find that interesting. And I suppose you could also say that although we in the West can be more open about the way we understand our sexuality and the way in which we choose to shape and reshape our personal lives, it's certainly not easy. And I think that they feel close to those characters who are also trying to find their way, and quite encouraged to hear that it's not just them, and it's not just now. It's always been difficult to find your way. The other thing that they talk about is about missed opportunities, particularly, and this is actually true of people who are not, you know, the readers who are not in the arts. You know, this terrible fear that if you make the safe choice, the one your parents want, the manufacturer of soap, if you like, that you're going to somehow be missing and losing the most important things in life and letting down the people you love most. So this is, I think, a kind of indication to me that the younger generation is not as free as it looks, not as confident as it sometimes seems, very, very much worried about, you know, making a life in this tough economy that we have now. And how can they be true to the things they love and believe in?
Maureen Freely, thank you.
Thank you.
Maureen Freely is president of English Pen, defending writers and free expression. She's translated Sabahattin Ali's work into English for a talking policy post on the World Policy blog, discussing the state of Turkey's literary and media culture and why Ali's 1943 novel Madonna in a Fur Coat resonates so strongly with Turkish readers today. Featured in the new WPJ winter issue, Coverline Native Voices, you'll find an inside account of struggles behind the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights and articles about a flawed treaty in New Zealand, rediscovered native roots in Norway, and the viral battle being waged by Bedouin Arabs. Plus, Portugal's growing economic prospects, Nigeria's growing cinema industry, Nollywood, and much more. World Policy on Air is a production of World Policy Journal at the nonprofit World Policy Institute in New York. Editor Jessica Laudis, managing editor Laurel Jerombeck, podcast producer Isabel Vazquez. I'm David Alpern.